to order. This is House Fisheries, and today is Monday, April 2nd. Thank goodness not the first, huh? And present are Representative Edgman, Representative Johansson, Representative Ledoux, and myself, Chair Seaton. And it is now 8:42 in the morning, and today we are continuing with public testimony and discussion of HB 198, Management of Sustainable Salmon Fisheries. And I wanted to draw everyone's attention to a response email we have from Lance Nelson in our packet. That is the same memo that you have received previously, but it was in such tiny font that it took double pairs of glasses to read. So this is exactly the same email, just in a larger font for everybody's convenience. Let's see, before we go to public testimony, and I think we'll take public testimony before we go to Lance Nelson of the Department of Law. Is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? Okay, or as we all know, everything has getting jammed up with Persian TERS and oil and gas and a number of other things, and so turned out that none of us were able to get out of our meetings to go to our field trip on Friday. And so we'll look in the future if there's a time where people are interested in going out there where we don't have all those conflicts, and we can check with them at that time. Seeing nothing else, let's go to Steve Runyon. Are you online there in the Mat-Su?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Would you identify yourself on the record and who you're representing, and go ahead with your testimony?
Good morning. My name is Steve Runyon. I'm representing the Matanuska Valley Advisory Committee to Fish and Game. And my testimony is just that I'm supporting this bill in that the sustainable salmon, or the policy for the management of sustainable salmon fisheries, which this bill strengthens and puts in as law rather than regulation, is a guiding policy to management of fisheries in Alaska, and really it sets forth guidelines to the Department of Fish and Game, the Board of Fisheries, and the legislature to follow in regards to managing our salmon fisheries for all user groups. And in the last meeting of the Board of Fisheries, that policy was, there was a proposal put in by the United Fishermen of Alaska to strike that policy from regulation and start out anew. I feel, and we here in the Mat-Su Valley feel, that that would be taking a huge step backward in the management of our fisheries. And this bill, rather than weakening that policy, actually strengthens it and does make it more clear to the managing parties the path which they can take in managing these fisheries. As having this policy, AAC 39.222, the policy for the management of sustainable salmon fisheries, in regulation in the state, has been a wonderful tool for the sales of our commercial fish stocks. It has allowed the marketing as wild salmon, which is key to the growth of that industry. It also has been key in directing former Commissioner Campbell how to go about identifying concerns and seeking a direction where the management needs to be focused on. In his term, he secured funding from the legislation to begin salmon stock studies in the Susitna drainage, which had not been taken, including fish wheels, pit studies of the sockeye, identifying where they're spawning, and the extent of habitat loss and degradation due to introduced species, northern pike in specific. Section 4, subsection subsection D in the sustainable salmon policy actually help define that direction. And I think it's just very important that this bill be voted upon and enacted as legislation in the state. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for Steve Runyon? Now, Steve, are you? You said you were the chairman of the advisory committee?
No, I'm not the chair of the advisory committee. I am a member of the advisory committee.
Oh, okay, thanks. And Steve, I had a question. As a member of the advisory committee then, and that advises the Board of Fish on local issues, you're comfortable with taking the ability of the Board of Fish to modify policies that they create out of their hands and fix it in state statute, so and remove that authority from the board to create policies to manage this fish. Is that correct?
The way I understand this bill is reading, this does not take authority away from the Board of Fisheries. What this does is provide direction to the Board of Fisheries and why they and how they manage. If you would, the four section E in this bill reads that public support and involvement for sustained use and protection of salmon resources shall be sought and encouraged in an open process, which already is what is happening. And then E, nothing in the policy set out in this section is intended to expand, reduce, or be inconsistent with the statutory regulatory authority of the board, speaking of the board of the Board of Fisheries, the department, or other state agencies with regulatory authority that affects fishery resources of the state. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think this bill, and I know this bill is not intended in any way, shape, or form to take authority away from the Board of Fishery.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Any further questions? See no further questions, Seth. Thanks for your testimony, Steve. We have Bruce Knowles also, Matt Sue. Are you online, Bruce?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Thank you. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, sir. I'm Bruce Knowles, and I'm talking for the AOC, Alaska Outdoor Council, today.
Okay.
I also serve on the Matanuska Susitna Valley Fish and Game Advisory Board. I serve on the Matsu Borough Blue Ribbon Outdoors Group, which the borough has set up. And I just follow along with what Mr. Runyon said. Last week I heard quite a few comments about concerns with your committee, and they were concerned about the salmon management plan taking control away from the department and the commissioner and the board, and it doesn't. The sustainable salmon management plan is like a 12-inch paint roller. When you go in and start doing a paint job, you do the general areas, the big areas, with a paint roller. And then when it comes down to specifics, you have to have a fine paint brush. And the fine paint brushes are the salmon management plans, which come out of the sustainable salmon policy. And you have to have the policy to help set up these the sustainable salmon policy to set up these salmon management plans in each individual area. This plan policy for the sustainable salmon is actually neutral in its nature. It's user neutral. The people all are on equal terms. You take the data that's available and you make your best choices using the data that the department has. Another concern I had heard was that there were going to be a bunch of lawsuits over it. There has not been any lawsuits over the sustainable salmon policy since it's been instituted that I'm aware of, and I couldn't find any this past few nights looking on the computer. The only lawsuits that have come out is lawsuits over the salmon management plan that was developed by the Board of Fisheries. And the only lawsuits that have come out have been by commercial fishing organizations. At Cook Inlet, in the last decade, there have been numerous lawsuits concerning salmon management plans, and they have been sued repeatedly by commercial fishing groups. And I cannot find other ones because I don't know what to look for and other regions of Alaska for lawsuits. There's not been one by a sport fishing group that I know of suing under the sustainable salmon plans. It's a foot into the next generation of management, and I think we just need to maintain it. This will give us an even keel to carry us into the next generation with salmon management. We've got problems here in Cook Inlet that need to be resolved, and with a salmon management plan, we can do that. And I just appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Bruce, I guess part of the concern is that when you have a salmon management plan, which is a policy direction to manage a species under, it's somewhat different than when you put it in statute, and such as on page 2, line 12, that where it says in law, it would be that diversity shall be maintained to the maximum extent possible at the genetic, population, species, and ecosystem levels. And so you are not concerned that other groups will now have a statutory provision under which to challenge decisions that are made that might not be seen to shall maintain to the maximum extent possible at the genetic level that diversity. You're not concerned of a lawsuit on that basis?
Sir, it has been proven in court that they can sue under a management plan, like the Northern District Salmon Management Plan, the Kenai River Salmon Management Plan, and those that are just management plans under a policy now without it being in statute. So I don't see that it would make a lot of difference. What it would make difference is that it would require better information, and require that we have better information to make decisions with for the Board of Fisheries. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Are there any other questions for Bruce? Okay, thank you. And now let's go to Fairbanks, Dick Bishop. Dick, are you online, and would you identify yourself and who you're representing for the record, and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dick Bishop. I'm president of the Alaska Outdoor Council. I'm testifying also on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council. Didn't realize that Bruce was going to be online. He has said most of what I needed to address, but I would just point out to the committee that at its recent annual statewide meeting, the delegates to the Alaska Outdoor Council voted to support and recommend passage of House Bill 189. And I wanted to convey that to the committee. I wanted to also point out that as things are structured in Alaska, I think it's a really good system with the Constitution laying out the principles of sustained yield, common use, and so on, and the legislature then has the opportunity and the responsibility to implement that policy and philosophy through statute and the boards, such as the Board of Fisheries, to take it to the working level through the details of regulation. And I would agree that putting the sustained salmon management policy, rather than limiting the flexibility of the board, I think what it does or would do would be provide a sound foundation that in its decisions about allocations, which are affected by not only biological considerations, but the interests of public and the various user groups, it would provide a consistent and sound foundation that would confirm the board's ability and authority to choose among options for management that would be consistent with statute and with the constitutional provisions that they interpret. So I think it's a step in the right direction, and you've heard a lot about the development of the policy. It was done at a time when there was not clear direction from the legislature on interpreting sustained yield, and the board went through an extensive process of both public input and technical review in order to develop that policy, and it has served its purpose well. I think that it is important to put it in its proper place, which is in the category of statute with the direction on policy of that broad nature coming from the legislature. So I don't at all see that it limits the board, but rather supports the and confirms the authority of the board to make those choices, and it also helps to ensure that the department provides the appropriate kind and level of information on a regular basis so that the board can make those decisions. So I guess that pretty well summarizes our perspective on it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Dick. Are there any questions for Mr. Bishop? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Yes, we don't have the sign-up sheet yet. It's coming. Go ahead and come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Alan Osterman. I'm testifying today on behalf of myself. I've spent a lot of time in the last few years watching what happens in the fishing industry, and the Cook Inlet is one that I'd say 12 or 15 years ago somebody mentioned that you've solved Cook Inlet and you've solved all your fishing problems in the state. I don't know whether that's necessarily true or not, but HB 189 appears to be a discrete stock management scheme, and I can understand the frustrations of the Upper Cook Inlet people that are involved in watching what's happened to their fisheries up there, and I don't think that this is necessarily the right answer. I'm more concerned with what the Department of Fish and Game has for funding and what their mandates are in establishing what the real problems are in the Upper Cook Inlet. I think last year we saw the Cook Inlet Regional Aquaculture Association come forward and say that there's a number of different issues on the lake systems in the Upper Cook Inlet, the Matsu, that maybe they're not producing the fish that need to be produced. Maybe the limnology of those lakes is not good enough to produce the fish that need to come out. At the same point in time, the Department of Fish and Game was asking for $1 million to do a tagging study to see where the fish that do come up back, where they actually go. And the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association said that, you know, we want to know what comes out as well, and what is the ability of those lake systems to produce the fish that need to be produced. I think there's a bit of a disconnect in the department in reference to the holistic view of what happens in the Upper Cook Inlet in the Matsu Valley and why those fish are not returning. If it's interception, which some people say it is, that their returns are not great enough to produce the fish, that's one question. But if the escapement is there and the fish are not coming back out in the spring, that's a whole different situation. And so I think that the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association put their own money up last year out of frustration of trying to figure out exactly what the problem was rather than just pointing their finger downstream and saying it's an intercept issue and we now have a discrete stock management plan in front of us based upon some of the frustrations that were coming out of there. Part of the department's, I'm not putting all the blame on the Department of Fish and Game. You know, they need money to manage with. They need money to take care of the situations that are there. As the state of Alaska continues to grow in the population, it becomes more acute problems around the state as to the needs of everybody and how you handle them. It behooves the legislature to make sure that, number one, the department has the funding to do the job. Number two, they have the mandate to make sure that everything gets done in the way that it should be. And as corporate officers of the state, the legislature has that responsibility to make sure that they are doing their job, but making sure that they have the funding to do it. I think a prime example of this type of a problem probably took place in the mid-'80s, late-'80s in Kodiak, on places like the Karlik Lake. They went into Karlik Lakes, and for over, I can't remember the number of years, but something like 7 or 8 years, they fertilized Karlik Lake. And the production of Karlik Lake just blossomed totally from what it had been based upon the fact that they actually went in and fertilized it. So I think there are ways of doing this stuff, but somebody has to make those kind of decisions and step forward and say, we need those answers, and now's the time to do it. So I think that discrete stock management is not necessarily the right way to go, but it behooves the legislature to make sure that the department has the funds and the mandate to do the job. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Alan. Are there questions for Alan? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 189? Anyone else online? Other than Lance Nelson? Okay. I just wanted to get the most of the public over first. So let's go online. Lance Nelson, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. We have an email from you. Would you kind of lead us through your testimony on this bill and the questions you're raising? Would appreciate that.
I'd be happy to. I have some introductory remarks.
That would be fine as well.
Just referring to the...
excuse me, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you're representing?
Thank you, I will. My name is Lance Nelson. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General in the Natural Resources Section of the Attorney General's Office in Anchorage. I've worked with the Board of Fisheries over a span of quite a few years, but I've probably been a primary advisor to them for about 10 years. I've also spent all my time since 1988, just about involved in either commercial fisheries regulation or commercial fisheries enforcement work. And I spent the last 9 years or so as probably the lead attorney for the Board of Fisheries in advising them and the department on fisheries issues. Turning for just a minute to the sustainable salmon fishery policy that's found in regulation, I would just like to point out that nobody has found any fault with the merit of that regulation, the substance of that regulation. The only objection that's come, and that was the proposal that was put forward by the United Fishermen of Alaska, was that it be put into policy form as opposed to regulation. That was explained in the record of the Board of Fisheries meeting, where the board recently considered that proposal to take the policy out of regulation and put it into policy form. The Board of Fisheries has many policies, it's a notebook full of policies that they follow and use as a guideline in managing the fisheries. Nevertheless, the board unanimously rejected the proposal to take the policy out of regulation and has appointed a committee to study ways that it might be tweaked or improved and reevaluated in the same kind of process that was used when the board was originally formulated and adopted by the board. So the question so far has been, hasn't been an issue of should it be scrapped, should it be in regulation or should it be in a policy. The arguments for being in policy are that most of the sustainable salmon fishery policy is not what we define as regulation. It sets goals and ideals for the way things should be in fisheries management, but it doesn't actually regulate the public. It also sets up a process that the board and department uses to approach issues with sustainable salmon fisheries. But it's largely not what you'd normally call a regulation. It's a management approach, a policy. We had some concerns at the Department of Law with the bill, with the policy being in regulation, but all those concerns I think we can deal with. What happens when you put it in statutes, our concerns probably quadruple and get much more serious. And I'll just go through my email here and talk about some of the concerns we have. Generally, we think this bill will tend to micromanage and set very difficult or impossible standards and will likely result in increased legal challenges. One thing I'd like to point out, if it's put in statute, this isn't going to be a guiding policy. It's going to be a strict mandate, a strict legal mandate, not just a policy that gives more authority or gives guidance to the board. It's direction that will have to be followed. One concern we have that with reference in A1 about a comprehensive policy, this isn't a major concern, but we're just concerned that every regulatory plan would have to be comprehensive, and that for the information we have on many of the stocks, the smaller stocks especially, and less valuable stocks, it wouldn't be practical for us to be able to guarantee that. Under paragraph A2, referencing that, almost all regulatory plans are designed to achieve maximum or optimum salmon production. So the department would literally have to affirmatively supply data on each of the listed criteria that set out in that provision, and the board would have to formally consider all the criteria, regardless of whether each was an important factor in the particular proposal before the board. In such cases, experience shows that consideration tends to be, over time, turn into a more formal rote recitation of the criteria without translating to a better, more informed decision. However, failure to expressly address any of the criteria could result in successful legal challenges against board regulations. One other thing I'll point out here, too, is that we have been sued under the Salmon Fisheries Policy Regulation in the summer of 2005, I guess it is. We were sued by Cordova fishermen. Oh, no, let me see. It may have been last summer. Sorry. Cordova, I didn't handle the case. Stephen Doherty did. But we were sued by Cordova District Fishermen United. One of their claims was that the regulatory plan was not consistent with the sustainable salmon fisheries policy. We've also been sued by the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association on the grounds that our regulation was inconsistent with the escapement goal policy, which is a companion regulation to the sustainable salmon fisheries policy. So we do know that litigation does occur. And we think it would be much more difficult to defend things if this policy, particularly the language of this policy, was in statute. Another concern we have is under subsection B, the phrase must ensure, we believe, sets an impossible standard for salmon management. Ensure means to guarantee a result which is impossible given the way salmon return and the limits on the state's ability to control their entire life cycle. Certainly, the board has very limited control over the marine habitat of salmon and really no power to ensure what the bill requires, the sustained economic health of Alaska. In subsection C, the term shall imposes new difficult standards. For example, in C1, the board is required, board and department are required to ensure sustained yield. But even in the sustained yield provision of the Alaska Constitution, which is Section 4, Article 8, there is no mandate that salmon stocks be maintained to ensure sustained yield. The constitutional provision says fish shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. That language has been interpreted with flexibility in light of the record of the Constitutional Convention, which states, in pertinent part, as to forest, timber, volume, rate of growth, and acreage of timber, type can be determined with some degree of accuracy. For fish, for wildlife, and for some other replenishable resources, it is difficult or even impossible to measure accurately the factors by which a calculated sustained yield could be determined. Yet the term sustained yield principle is used in connection with management of such resources. When so used, this is a critical part, it denotes conscious application insofar as practicable of principles of management intended to sustain the yield of the resource being managed. That broad meaning is the meaning of the term as used in the article. And that was quoted in the Navy Village of Elam versus State case, which challenged commercial fishery and subsistence regulations for chum salmon in western Alaska. In that case, the Supreme Court went on to elaborate as follows. The primary emphasis of the framers' discussions and the glossary's definition of sustained yield is on the flexibility of the sustained yield requirement and its status as a guiding principle rather than a concrete, predefined process. The language in the bill, on the other hand, would impose a standard of strict guarantee, in other words, a concrete, kind of predefined process. Under C2 of the bill, the directive shall be managed to allow escapement within ranges necessary to conserve and sustain wild salmon production and maintain normal ecosystem functioning is also problematic. It does not recognize the variables at work in salmon management. Our Supreme Court has been pretty good about giving the department and board enough flexibility to handle the complicated issues involved in salmon management. And an example comes from the Native Village of Meadow case also, where they say, the salmon in these waters are subject to numerous pressures, any one of which could account for a population decrease in a given year. A short and incomplete list of these factors includes weather, natural predators, competition with other fish, international fishing efforts, water pollution, and improved efficiency of fleets and fishing methods. Moreover, several different species of salmon travel through the fishery, thus creating a mixed stock that increases challenges of management. The record also shows that the salmon operate on a fluctuating cycle that makes estimating returns from year to year difficult, even under the best of conditions. We believe that the use of mandatory terms like shall and ensure in salmon management statutes sets up unrealistic expectations and invites legal challenges, which are more likely to be successful with that kind of language. Provision C4 could also be interpreted to require the board to shut down any mixed stock fishery that involves take of a depleted salmon stock, regardless of consequences to other fisheries or other escapement objectives. That's also reflected in D4 as well. The failure to define the terms depleted and actively stored also raises concerns. You could be in a situation where a relatively low rate of interception of a depleted stock could result in closure of a fishery, causing significant overescapement or possibly harming production of another stock, even while providing little benefit to the depleted stock. Other paragraphs of subsection C also contain problematic language, such as to the extent, maximum extent possible and priority. Those kind of terms are red flags in the legal world. Similar language and regulation can be addressed, if necessary, by qualifying language in another regulation, such as by adding a notwithstanding provision. And further, the board receives great deference in interpreting its own regulations. However, if this type of language is put in statute, the board will not have any discretion to do anything but follow the letter of the statutory language. In subsection D, the language best available information could be problematic because it might be construed to require the department and board seek out and review all possible information rather than what they deem to be the most critical. Anyone could argue that there was better information available and the board did not hear or consider it. The board normally relies upon a short report from the department and consideration of all public comments submitted to it and adoption of its regulatory decisions. Similarly, the department normally relies principally upon fish ticket and escapement information collected by the department and development of its reports and recommendations to the board. While this information is often extensive and other information is available from the internet, scientific journals, and other sources, and it could certainly be argued that some of this information may be, quote unquote, better regarding discrete issues. This bill could be interpreted to require the department board to proactively gather and review this information, even if not presented by a member of the public. Thus, if this bill were enacted, department recommendations and board decisions would be vulnerable to potentially successful legal challenges unless the department commits significant new resources to doing a thorough scientific review of all potentially relevant background information and presents the resulting information to the board for consideration with regard to each of the several hundred proposals considered by it each year. This would require increased staffing of biologists and economists and would significantly extend the time necessary for board meetings. Under D1, the language applies to human activities that affect salmon, but the statutory authority of the board extends generally to fishing activities and not many other activities that affect salmon, some of which are more specifically regulated by other state agencies, such as salmon stream activity permitting under AS 4114.870, which is handled by the Department of Natural Resources now. Under D2, every management plan would have to contain goals and measurable objectives. This connotes a formulaic equation-type approach to management plans that works in some fisheries, but there are probably current plans that do not specifically express goals and measurable objectives because of the nature of those fisheries or the lack of information. They would be subject to challenge under this provision. Paragraph D3 has the same kind of language that sets the board and department up for easy challenges to regulations and department actions. The language on habitat restoration and protection measures is largely outside the authority of the board or department. And in D4, as I referenced before in my discussions with C, you could have a situation where small, less valuable, depleted runs would be mandated to be allowed to recover, meaning that harvest of more valuable stocks would likely have to be foregone because of that. There's one other point I'd like to make, and that's the fact that this statute would not only subject regulatory action to challenge, but every department decision related to salmon management, including preparation of reports for consideration by the board and other in-season decisions, would also be subject to challenge if this bill were enacted. So those are some of the concerns that we have. And as an attorney for any state agency, it's hard to see something coming that sets your agency up for and makes it vulnerable in its decision-making process. And I think this bill does that, and that's the basis of our concerns.
Thank you. Are there questions for the Department of Law? Lance, I know it's not in your prepared testimony here, but I'm trying to get a little further handle on the implication if this was in statute versus the commissioner's EO authority, emergency order authority for managing, for in-season management. Can you just lead us through that discussion a little bit or what implications this might have?
Well, as I said, I think, Mr. Chairman, all these provisions generally apply to the department as well as the board. So, for example, under C4, in-season management decision, it says depleted salmon stock shall be allowed to recover or, where appropriate, be actively restored. The commission would have to decide whether an EO allowing a fishery on an abundant stock was going to be consistent with this provision because some minor stock, you know, maybe a chum salmon stock that's not considered very valuable by any of the sport, commercial, or personal use or subsistence fisheries might be depleted. But in order to protect that run, to ensure sustained yield of that run, the commissioner might have to change his judgment call on that and allow a lot less fishing on the more abundant stock. It's interesting to note that in the constitutional provision on sustained yield, that you have that qualifying language that says subject to preferences among beneficial uses. And that's the kind of judgment call the board and the department have to make all the time. They have to decide, you know, are we going to be able realistically to make sure that every stock does its very best? Or can we decide based on user interest or the market value or the economic effect on the state that we prefer one over the other and let the other suffer while the more valuable one increases? And that's true in a lot of our regulatory plans. We do that. And there are always going to be some people who disagree with that. But I think it could have a major effect on the way the commissioner and his designees make decisions through EOs and other management decisions throughout the season.
Thank you, Lance. We had discussion from someone in Fairbanks testifying the other day about king salmon and the genetic difference between those that return at 8 years versus 6 years and as a population, and saying that the 8-year-old were pretty much gone from the population as a, and they were talking about them as a genetic stock. And I guess what I'm curious on your position on page 2, lines 12 and 13, for the mandate that diversity shall be maintained to the maximum extent possible at the genetic population, species, and ecosystem levels. You know, my concern was that if there is not considered to be a good population, I'll just use a very broad term of, or let's say an adequate population of 8-year-old returning king salmon. If this was enacted in statute, do you believe that that would be a basis for a group to be able to file a challenge against king salmon fishing on the river to maintain a adequate population of that 8-year-old component of the stock?
Well, I don't want to exactly, in case this bill is enacted, I don't want to open this up too much, but definitely the person testifying believed that that would be required under this, and it would definitely be a basis of a lawsuit that would do that. And certainly it would raise a very serious issue, and the board would, if this provision was in place, we would certainly require the board to probably spend about twice as much time on those kind of regulations and the department, too, to make sure that we had a good explanation for why we could do what the board wanted to do and why it would be consistent with this law. So there's definitely an issue there that looks fairly serious.
Okay, thank you. And didn't mean to put you on the spot there. I was just trying to get an example that was, brought forward in public testimony. Are there any other questions for the Department of Law? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else in the room that wants to testify? Anyone else online? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. And we have HB 189. Is there committee discussion? I think that we've raised a number of very significant issues here. That putting this in there might change the entire almost intent of the Constitution from flexible management under sustained yield to this and being a guiding principle to being a strict mandate. We've got other issues. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to have those issues or a lot of them to be analyzed. So we'll put this in the subcommittee, and that will be with Chair Wilson, or Representative Wilson will be Chair, Representative Ledoux and Representative Edgman as the other committee members. Like I say, there are significant issues to be addressed there, but there's a lot of detail to go with each one of those issues. Is there anything else to come before Fisheries Committee this morning? Seeing nothing, we'll stand adjourned, and it is 9:25, and thank you, committee.